Dreams, Gifts from the Unconscious, a lecture by June Singer. Presented by the C.G. Jung Institute of Chicago on September 21st, 1975.
Joan and Stan Groff make a very hard act to follow, particularly because I'm an analyst. And after what they said about analysis, it almost puts me in a defensive position, but not quite, because I'm not a psychoanalyst, I'm not of the traditional analytic school, but I belong to the school of Jungians, and so I'm a follower of that rebellious psychologist who broke away from Freud because he felt that the personal view of the unconscious was far too limited, and who himself had experiences of a transpersonal nature which in many ways resembled some of the things that the Groffs were talking about, and who also came in touch with those kinds of experiences with his patients. And so he approached the unconscious in quite a different way. Now, Jung was interested in the study of dreams because, for one reason, they supply an ongoing, day-by-day contact, or I should say night-by-night contact with the unconscious, so that we can live in a relationship with the unconscious without having to depend on these tremendous experiences, which I grant are extremely important and opening up experiences. But there's also the importance of the day-by-day contact and the being a friend of the unconscious and knowing the unconscious as a part of oneself that one can be in constant touch with, and not something that has to be feared or anticipated or prepared for, but a part of everyday living. Now, every day in my work, I'm confronted with the question of what is real. Every day I work on the dreams that people bring me, and I hear them say, this and this happened in a dream, and then they go on to relate it to what happened in what they call real life. So often as I sit there listening, I wonder, why do we feel that dreams are not real life, or that real life is something quite different from a dream? The Taoist sage Chuang Tzu, who transcended the illusory dust of the world, tells a story in his inner chapters about the equality of all things. In his writing, he responds to a question asked by the Lady Li, who was the daughter of a border guard and was taken captive by the Duke of Qin. At first, she wept until her dress was soaked with tears. But after a while, she got used to the palace and to enjoying sharing the Duke's bed and the delicious food that was provided. And she became very happy. And she wondered why she had cried so bitterly. And she asked the question, how can I tell whether the dead are not amazed that they ever clung to life? Chuang Tzu responds to this question, and he says, those who dream of a great feast may weep the next morning. Those who dream of weeping may enjoy the hunt the next day. While they dream, they do not know they are dreaming. Only after they awake do they know it was a dream. Some may even interpret their dreams while dreaming. By and by, there will be a great awakening, and then we will know that this is all a great dream. All the while, the fools think they are awake, appearing to understand things, calling this man ruler and that man herdsman. How stupid. When you say you are dreaming, I'm dreaming too. Now, these words may sound like double talk, yet after 10,000 generations, we will meet a great sage who can explain all this, or it may happen any day now. That's the end of the quote from Chuang Tzu. Now, my dear friends, in case you're expecting that I am that sage who is going to explain to you the nature of dreams, I'm going to have to tell you that I can't do that. When I was a child, I paid attention to my dreams, although I didn't understand them then and often carried them around with me through the days. When later I studied psychology, I learned that dreams were associated with rapid eye movements and that dream states could be monitored on an electroencephalograph, so that one could tell the frequency of the brain waves whether one was dreaming or not. Then I went through my analysis, and I learned that dreams were a product of the unconscious and that we could discover a lot about ourselves by working with our dreams. And then I was training to become a Jungian analyst, and I learned a theoretical approach to the interpretation of dreams, how to use this to uncover the deeper layers of the psyche, and especially of the psyche of disturbed and depressed or distressed or neurotic or psychotic individuals. Now that all this is behind me, I still pay attention to my dreams and to those of other people, and I often carry them around with me through the day, but it's stored in this magnificent supercomputer we call the human brain. The human computer, being alive, has the capacity to regenerate itself and to energize itself and to motivate itself and execute its own orders. So this living computer that has been programmed by its genetic components in the first place now processes the information it receives. It's able to scan a vast array of information from the physical world and the human world and from history and the contemporary arts and sciences. If mere machines can accomplish what they do in the solution of technical problems, why should we be surprised if the living computer that is the brain can make statements about what is happening in distant places, can inform individuals about their own problems and needs, and even predict the future? Why should we be surprised if the biopsychological organ that invented the computer should also have the power to reach deep into the human psyche and guide explorers into many fields of consciousness? I don't say that we are explorers of the unconscious, for I feel that the distinctions we make between consciousness and the unconscious in traditional psychology are too gross to be very useful.